Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and this is the concluding part of my interview with Faber poet Julia Kopus. I began this part of our discussion by asking Julia about one of the longest poems in the book, The Particella of Franz Xaver Süssmayr. Why had she decided to write about Mozart's scribe, who accompanied Mozart's pregnant wife to a spa town in the last summer of the composer's life?
I think that poem came out of my preoccupation with time, which I think is very evident in this new collection. I'm interested in different aspects of time, the way that we view time. And going back to the ancient Greeks, they had two different words for time. They had chronos, from which we get chronological. So chronos refers to normal serial time, if you like. But they also had a word, kairos, which refers to an opportune moment, a moment in which something extraordinary or perhaps even life-changing takes place. So these are the kind of moments that I'm very interested in my poems. And in fact, a lot of the shorter lyrics concentrate on these moments of kairos, moments in which we are transformed as humans. So with the Süssmayr poem, although it's, you know, the longest poem in the book, in fact, it centres around this tiny, tiny moment of kairos. It's written about Franz Süssmayr, and I said that I was interested in what happens in the wings and in the minor characters. And we know a lot about Mozart, but we know very little, or I knew very little about Süssmayr. The time that I've set the poem, it's in the last year of Mozart's life, and he's writing The Magic Flute, you know, one of the greatest pieces of music ever to have been written. But Süssmayr is living a very different life. He's Mozart's right-hand man, and Mozart used him to write what are called particella, which means short scores, really. So Mozart would write sketches of what he wanted to do, then give them to Süssmayr, and Süssmayr would write these particella, which are essentially sort of a top line and a bass line, and then he would give them back to Mozart to refine and develop and orchestrate. But he also used them in other ways, and in this, when the poem is set, he has sent his pregnant wife Constanza away to Baden, which is a sort of health-giving spring resort near Vienna, and he sent her there because she's got swollen feet from her pregnancy, and he's using Süssmayr to as a sort of nurse to look after Constanza while she's in Baden. And of course, it's a very risky strategy because he falls in love with Constanza while he's away. So this long poem centres around this tiny, tiny moment when Constanza, with whom Süssmayr's already half in love, stumbles as she's walking down to the waters and catches hold of Süssmayr's hand. And at the same time, her hair swings loose and brushes against his shoulder. So it's this tiny moment, but it's a moment of intimacy that changes Süssmayr for good. So really, it's a love poem.
When I was rereading the poem again this morning, I was very struck by how much water there is in it. Yes. Fountains and rain. Yes. And the waters of the spa. And also that made me think how much water there is in fact in the whole collection. There is water running through it.
Yeah.
And it's in the water that this epiphany, almost this moment of connection, which maybe he imagined. Do we know whether or not some, I mean, it seems that some of it might be in his imagination, or some of the there's a certain degree of embroidery. He's quite a loquacious character, isn't he? And the reader, I think, is left wondering how much of it is real and how much of it is the fact that he's got this imagination that's working in over time.
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of it is going on in his head. In a way, that doesn't matter, because it doesn't change things, because the way he feels is the way he feels, you know, regardless of whether or not Constanza returns his feelings. And as for the water, I think subconsciously and maybe even consciously, I certainly in this poem equate water with love. So in a section, a part of the poem near the beginning, you've got a wrinkled old tree and a fountain next to it, and they don't quite meet. There's this little distance between them, and that's how he feels. He's like the tree that is just aching to be wet a little bit. And then the poem ends with this image of Constanza's bonnet on the side of the bank filling with rain. So the moment that he's experienced with Constanza, this moment of great love, intimacy, eroticism for him, will be with him forever, and he imagines her bonnet filling with Bardon rain.
When I started reading your poetry, Julia, before I read any profiles of you, I wrote down the words "the road not taken," because it seemed to me that often in your work you came to a bifurcation or a point at which one's history could go in one direction or another. And that seems to be something, even in that extract you've just read, she's thinking about if she doesn't light the lamps, then events, life will go in a completely different direction. What does that date back to a particular time, or is that have you always been fascinated by the sort of multiple possibilities, the shadow selves?
Well, shadow selves is exactly the right term. It's a term that quantum physicists use, and I am very, very interested in these moments in our life which happen all the time when we could have chosen X or chosen Y. So we choose Y, but what happens to the person who might have chosen X? In my mind, that person still exists, and quantum physicists say that is in fact the case, that we have these shadow selves living out every what if we've ever asked ourselves. I think actually going back to my own life, there was a period when my parents divorced when I was six, where, you know, we ended up living with my mother. And I felt quite strongly then, from that age, I think, what would have happened if we'd stayed with my father? Would I have gone to a different school and therefore met different people, chosen different subjects at school, you know, and therefore had a completely different life? So I think from quite an early age, I've been very aware of other choices that can be made, and just find it fascinating that in terms of physics, this is a possibility or you know, some people say a definite fact that other versions of us are out there living these other versions of our lives.
The epigraph to the whole collection from Hilary Mantel,
yeah.
What is to be done with the lost but write them into being? The poetry is a means to make palpable those other possibilities, isn't it?
Yes, in poems, those other lives can exist. You can write about those lives as if they are taking place in a real way, as real a way as as actuality. So poetry, my own poetry, allows me to explore those other possibilities, I think, not just of my own choices, but of, you know, every available choice for every character that I write about.
You are associated with a form that you've perhaps, I don't know, is this a specular form your own creation, or are there antecedents in poetry?
I'm said to have invented that form, although I've since discovered there is an antecedent. Somebody drew my attention to it on the internet, so I think it has been done before, only once to my knowledge, but I'm certainly credited with popularising it anyway. Yeah.
So this is a form in which the second half of the poem is a mirror image of the first,
yeah.
And it allows you to play with sequencing and time and the relationship between the parts. So do you remember how, was there a light bulb moment when you thought, actually this could, you know, you could begin to reverse and turn a poem inside out like that?
There was a light bulb moment, and it came from the writing of a poem. I said that I don't abandon poems very readily, so I'd written a poem about a traumatic incident, and it wasn't a very good poem. It was semi-autobiographical, and I think I was too close to the subject matter. And I noticed that in this unsuccessful draft I was beginning to repeat certain phrases and so on, and I thought about why I was doing that, and I realized that it was because that is the way that the mind remembers trauma, sort of repeatedly going back to the beginning and playing the whole incident over, so that in the end there becomes no beginning or end, it gets blurred. So I thought, well, what if I do this a bit more consciously and repeat things on purpose, and, you know, make the beginning the end, so the first line is exactly the same as the last line, and that is how it started.
And how do you begin to write a poem like that? Do you know before you set out that this is going to be a specular poem, or do sometimes poems grow in a direction where that becomes the thing that you want to do with them?
I think either way, whether you set out to write a specular poem or realise that it's leaning towards that way, there comes a moment when you decide that's what it's going to be. And then it's really like writing two poems at the same time, because as you're writing the first half of the poem, you have to be aware with every line how that sounds backwards. It's got to make sense both ways. So it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. And, you know, it is like writing two poems at the same time. But it has its payoffs because, as you say, it allows you to move between the present and the past. And I think as humans, we're made up of the past and to some extent the future as much as we are of the present. So I think it's a very suitable form for writing, especially about memory, but in general for writing about what it is to be human.
And as a reader, it makes you go back and reread and re-examine the relationship. I wonder if I could get you to read another poem, possibly The Silence Between Us. You talked earlier about how some of the lyrics demand such a concentrated effort that it's in a way comparable to the longer narrative poems.
Yes, there's a reference in this poem to Jan Grzebski, who was a Polish railway worker. In 1988, he fell in front of a train and into a coma. And then in 2007, he woke up from the coma to discover that the Iron Curtain had fallen and he'd gained 11 grandchildren while he was out of action. It's not bad going. But I use this as a central metaphor in the poem. This silence between us. This silence that lies between us like a body that long ago gave up responding to pain, still less to light, which is pain's opposite, that cannot hear and cannot be awakened, that is in fact incontinent and catatonic, but nonetheless demands to be sat beside and talked to, prayed for, cried over, whose limbs and torso must be gently sponged, forehead smoothed, even in the dead of night, especially in the dead of night, this silence. How long do you suppose it can continue? Miracles happen. Today, and not for the first time, I remember the story of Jan Grzebski, who woke one summer after 19 years. But it's his wife I picture, crossing the hallway for nearly two decades, the slap of her feet along the narrow passageway, the slop of water in a plastic bowl, till the morning when, half asleep, she recalls she's left the shutters open and the window lifted where a thin net curtain shivers in dusty sunlight as slowly the bedstead, the bulk of the body, zigzag into place in the frame of the doorway, sunlight, body, counterpane, all of it's just as it should be. But dear God, his eyes, like two bright fish aswim in the propped-up head. There are those who say that miracles are born of faith, that trust alone might make you turn and talk again. I lie down next to my body, so close I think I smell its sour breath. Still here, I whisper, but it does not stir. Then, gently, with a fingertip, I lift one leathery eyelid where the soul is crouched and speak to it directly. Not a flicker, but it does not faze me. It is only a matter of time before one of us wakes.
I think the hunt for correspondences between the poet's lived experience and the poetry is ultimately futile, or at least not the most interesting thing about poetry. Nonetheless, I'm interested in how a process of transmutation, or how your own lived experience becomes transformed into poetry. And I wondered if that was something you had reflected on.
I have reflected on it a lot, of course. I think the thing is that I'm not really interested in telling people about myself for its own sake. Why would they be interested? What I want to do is to communicate experiences that have a universal resonance, that spark some sort of recognition in the reader, that make them feel part of a bigger human tapestry, if you like. And I'm quite happy to use my own experiences in order to do that. It's about relevance, really, and resonance as well, and how strongly my own experiences and thoughts, emotions, feelings, after all, those are all we have in the end. We have our imagination, of course, but that is based on all of those things.
And also about time and the passage of time, and finding a way to give it that larger resonance, so it isn't just a piece of raw from the life experience, but something which goes further.
I think it's incredibly difficult to write about the now, to write about something that is happening right now. You need that time, you know, as Wordsworth said, poetry is based in emotion recollected in tranquility, and you need that distance between you and the experience in order to shape it and make sense of it, make it into something meaningful, make it into art.
So when you were thinking about the experiences which became the sequence of poems called Ghost, which ends the book, that presumably required distance and time and careful thought about how to tackle it. Can you say something about how that took shape?
Of course. I think that experience was, it is something that has happened to me, and it was so all-absorbing, so intense, that I was simply unable to think about anything else, least of all writing. So I did no writing while that was going on. And then when it was over, the echo, if you like, of it, of that experience was so resonant for me that when I felt able to write again, that is what I wanted to write about. Everything I tried to write about came back to that. So, in fact, those poems in the sequence were written over a period of a year or so. But I woke up one morning and had the whole shape of it in my head. I knew exactly, and even specific phrases, I woke up and I scribbled them down one morning. It's one of the few times that that's ever happened to me. So it was incredibly satisfying because I had the shape of it, and it didn't stray very far from that shape. But you're very right to say that it's something that happened afterwards and not concurrently with the actual events in my life. And the woman at the heart of that sequence doesn't feel like me. She feels like somebody quite different. So her responses, especially at the end when the procedure turns out not to have worked for her, is much more courageous, I think, than I actually was in real life.
Could I ask you perhaps through the opening poem of the sequence?
Yeah, sure, yeah. So I just want to say first that there have been a number of memorable poems written about parenthood, motherhood and fatherhood, but I was interested in exploring this idea of imagined parenthood, and in particular the journey through that landscape that a couple embarks upon when they sign up for IVF treatment. So this first poem is set in a noisy pub as the couple's embryos are fertilising in a clinic sort of 50 miles away or so from where they're sitting. At the farmer's inn, her lover lifts a pilsner to his lips, swallows it back till the order arrives, and they move like marionettes, eat without talking, devil kidneys, sea bass, creme brulee. The waitresses angle their hips between tables and carry the plates in the air, straight-limbed as matadors. Meanwhile, the men at the bar, afloat on their bar stools, are baying like seals. A forest of backs occludes both the girl and her tongue-tied lover. Out of the window, behind his head, night falls between the slats of the trestle tables, over the scotch grass and the sheep bunched in the corner of a field. The hubbub thickens the air like moth wings. It beats at the sides of her skull. Meal over, the day's a done deal, the dawn and the dusk, the seed, the eggs they harvested at noon with the consummate needle, drawing them off like tiny, luminous pearls from the sea of her body. Now they drink to the dregs of their coffee, call for the bill, link hands above the petit four, while 50 miles from here, along the unfurled ribbon of the street, the lamplit miles of motorway, in a clinic, a darkened room, like mushrooms, very whitely, discreetly, the longed-for lives begin.
Thank you. Again, we've got sea and we've got water, and I began noticing your fondness for the words afloat and a swim, which are quite unusual words, and I think that's why they sort of snagged in my memory. And I guess those words are significant because they suggest that we are travelling somewhere. We're not always in control of where we're going, but we are journeying somewhere.
Absolutely, that's very well spotted, and they are poems of, as you say, they're words of buoyancy and movement. And when I was younger, I had this horrible fear of stagnation. And I think the conclusion I came to was that it's important to keep moving in order not to stagnate. And in fact, I wrote about this in my second collection too. And in fact, it doesn't matter always which direction we're going in. It's not important to get the direction right necessarily. There isn't necessarily a right direction to go in, but the important thing is to go.
Because when you've got your bifurcations points, it isn't the case there's a right and a wrong, is it? They're just alternatives, yeah, which lead to different outcomes and then further bifurcations. But yeah, it's not a matter of going back to find out where something went wrong or something went right.
No, that's right. There isn't a right or a wrong way to do it. Louis MacNeice wrote a poem called Entirely, and he says there, if the world were black and white entirely and all the charts were plain, instead of a mad weir of tigerish waters, a prism of delight and pain, we might be surer where we wish to go, or again, we might be merely bored. But in brute reality, there is no road that is right entirely.
Maybe, Julie, we could conclude with a poem from the sequence Ghost. We could end with Inkling, which again brings in images of sea and a memorable image of the coracle.
So again, this poem is about a possibility, something that the speaker thinks might have happened, but she isn't entirely sure. And it's one of the few poems in this sequence that's written in the first person. So in this poem, the mother is speaking directly to her would-be child. Inkling. Last night, I sensed a taking root under the bone cage of my heart, a stirring, shifting, something not quite of a breath or heartbeat's weight. It was the inkling of a soul. Now I shall have no peace at all till he's caught and fastened, nested in the cradle of my pelvic bone. Then, in the coracle of my womb, I'll carry him gently every inch home, though the hour is late, in the lengthening light, to the crook of my arm, the bay's curved shore, water-lapped, twilit, secure.
Julia Copus. The World's Two Smallest Humans is available now in paperback. Her two earlier collections are also available. They are In Defense of Adultery and The Shuttered Eye. You can find out more about those books, and several million other titles besides, by going to blackwell.co.uk. There's also a podcast archive there with over 150 author interviews. Look for the podcast tab on the home page. And you can subscribe to the podcast by visiting iTunes and typing Blackwell in the search box under podcasts. This concludes my two-part interview with Julia Copus, but I'll be back soon with another Blackwell Online podcast. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.